This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is our Week in Review, but we're getting ambitious. We're reviewing an entire year that was spent in crisis.
Today, I'm declaring a state of emergency in Massachusetts.
To keep new cases from entering our shores, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
Is the worst yet to come, Dr. Fauci?
Yes, it is.
I hope it's being blown out of proportion and we did all this preparation for nothing. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the case.
It wasn't the case. We weren't blowing anything out of proportion. And now, in a world where every week feels like a year, we just had another one.
This is the one-year anniversary of the signing of the executive order here in Massachusetts that put the Commonwealth into a state of emergency.
A year ago, we were hit with a virus that was met with silence and spread unchecked. Denials for days, weeks, then months. That led to more deaths, more infections, more stress, and more loneliness.
It's been a horrible, horrible year for all of us, and it's been relentless. And I think the good news at this moment is that it is going to end and it's going to happen soon.
I've been continually inspired by the collective care and the mutual aid and the resilience of community.
It's a lot to review. So many voices there from two U.S. presidents, local elected officials, the head of the WHO, even Brown's Dr. Ashish Jha. Well, now we're going to welcome two more voices to help us talk about all of it on this Week in Review. Arlene Isaacson is the co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and president of Isaacson Political Consulting. Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Arlene, Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're going to dive right in, reflect on the year in the pandemic, what was, what is now, and what comes next. And we want to start with what was. Call in and share the memory from a year ago that is sticking in your head this week at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Arlene and Tom, I want to start there with the two of you. So many people this week have been telling me there's some memory from last year that's just with them right now. So what is it for each of you? Arlene, maybe you first.
Oh, Lord. That's a tough one to answer because, you know, I was recently rewatching the clip when the state of emergency was declared here, and it brought tears back to my mind, to my eyes. The prolonged pain and fear and trauma that we've all experienced, the individual and collective suffering and sacrifice have been enormous. And I say that knowing that I and my family are pretty lucky. You know, thankfully we haven't gotten sick. Thankfully we don't have to worry about putting food on the table or a roof over our heads. So we're so much luckier than so many other people that I always hesitate to complain. But it has been a year from hell for all of us, and frightening and painful.
Tom, how about you? Is there a particular moment from last year that's been really with you, staying with you this last week or so?
There's been two. One is when I first went out, when the first lockdowns came out, and I forget where I had to go. I was driving somewhere, and I realized how deserted everything was, and I thought, you know, I'm living in the future. This is the kind of thing you read about in science fiction stories, but suddenly it dawned on me, this is not just some inconvenience. I suppose it rattled my faith in living in an advanced modern civilization to say, you know, this thing could kill me. There are no people on the streets. This is real. This is not just some passing inconvenience. And I that's when I first started getting this kind of cold dread that, you know, this is going to kill more than a few thousand people around the world. This is going to change a lot of things. The other was when my brother died in the Holyoke Soldiers Home in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And we said, well, he died of old age, you know, and about a week or two later, it started to dawn on me. We don't know what he died of. he died in the middle of this mismanaged. I think that was, again, this moment of saying, wait, I can't just assume that my brother died of, Parkinson's or heart failure or whatever it was, because the whole place was in chaos. And I thought, this doesn't feel like living in a modern country anymore. This feels like living in the middle of chaos. And to this day, I don't really know what my brother died of at the soldiers' home.
That's haunting, Tom. I'm sorry about that. There's so much in what the two of you just said. I think there are two threads I want to pull out. The first, Arlene, you used the term trauma. You talked a little bit about your own experience. Clearly, the two memories we just heard from Tom are the kinds of memories that create trauma for people. We talk in sort of the service world, I come out of the human and social services before, about trauma-informed care. I wonder if we are trauma-informed in the ways that we are engaging with and treating each other these days, and what we could be doing better there, Arlene.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind we are deeply traumatized individually and collectively, and in many cases not recognizing it or realizing it just yet. I think it was revelatory for me to start crying when I saw that, when I rewatched the announcements about the state of emergency. The fact that could bring me to tears was a reminder of how much on the edge my emotions were at a time when we all struggled to keep them in check, to do the necessary, to try and be a good, decent, caring family member, friend, neighbor, et cetera, at a time when we've been living in a prolonged state of fear and panic. And what that does to the adrenal glands and to the brain and to the emotions is significant. But, I would often take solace in the good, and I don't mean to jump ahead and over the pain, but I found it very helpful to focus on some of the best of humanity that came to play during this time, from the healthcare professionals and workers who were risking their lives for us on a daily basis in huge ways, from the frontline workers, whether it was in a grocery store or at a janitorial staff, who were doing the same, and how we came, I believe, to appreciate a lot of the roles that people played in our day-to-day lives that we previously took for granted.
And so Tom, say that last part again, Arlene. I didn't hear that very last part, and I really want to hear it.
Just the fact that we took so many people for granted and hopefully won't ever again.
I hope we won't. And that makes me, so that's about what we do next and where we are now versus where we were then. And Tom, you said there was a moment where you felt like we were descending into chaos, and you no longer felt like you lived in one of these most developed nations. Do you still feel that way, or do you feel that we're returning to our collective efficacy?
There's good news and there's bad news. I think that the the development that the international community developing a vaccine, practically by vaccine standards overnight, really showed the power of a connected and technologically advanced world. I mean, 30 or 40 years ago, we'd have been living with this for years, and the death toll would have been unimaginable. So I do feel like we got our feet back under us. And to be positive about this, remember that the very worst, some of the worst, I shouldn't say all the worst, but some of the very worst predictions didn't come to pass, that the entire globalized economic system was going to fall apart, that we were going to go into a Great Depression, that, there was going to be the collapse of governments left and right, that, this was basically the end of the world. And that didn't happen. And it showed that the modern modern civilization is pretty tough and resilient. The bad news is that it really showed that we have lost. And I don't think I personally grieve for this, because I don't think we've brought it back. I feel like we've really lost the sense of community, of mutual assistance, of that kind of social fellow feeling that you need to sustain a democracy. I think this brought out the best in a lot of our frontline workers and the people that were really doing their best to get us through this. But I also think for a big swath of Americans, it really brought out what a bunch of selfish, entitled people, we've become. And I think that that's going to take, I don't know that, you know, I mean, I really have lost a lot of faith because of the way, not just the government. I mean, you know, it's too easy to blame Trump, although I think the former president bears a lot of responsibility for this. But it, you know, I think it really showed that somehow the sense that we had after major traumas, I mean, the first few days I felt like it was after 9/11 and we were all really pulling together, and that just didn't last very long. And I worry that we're not going to get that back.
So let's rise to that challenge. So listeners, 1-800-423-8255. I hear Tom. And I also wonder if we can tell ourselves some stories of support mutual aid times other than the frontline workers who we know are just knocking themselves out, the essential workers, but other random acts of kindness and support that you remember from the early months or that you've seen recently that can maybe help us all feel a little bit of the warmth of that light that we're hoping is at the end of the tunnel. So call with those stories and examples at 800-423-8255.
Of the things that I would throw into the mix that I noticed that at the external level, there were some really wonderful things that people who were in terrible straits shared with the rest of us. The performing arts and music industry, they were devastated. The employment crashed. They had no way of making a living, and yet they did wonderful things to help us get through. Museums put hundreds of thousands of images online for unrestricted public use. Plays and shows were sometimes available online for free. Ditto musical performances. And it was a blessing for those of us who found our way to them as a way to some occasionally escape the horrors that we were going through.
So I'm also smiling, Arlene, as you say that we have this process of taking calls. Remember, I'm remote, and I can see as the phones start to light up in the studio, it takes us a few minutes then to start talking to those callers. But as soon as I asked for stories of people being good to each other, boom, 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 the phone started to light up. So I think that's going to be kind of a fun back and forth for the rest of the hour here will be people telling their stories of goodness. Tom, you know, it's funny that you talked about losing your faith a little bit in our collective efficacy, because it was actually a question I was going to ask you in particular later in the show. So I'm glad that you brought it up. One of the things that it got me thinking about it is it's a 1-year anniversary of a state of emergency in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Just recently, it's as if the Massachusetts legislature has decided to take an active role after being really quite passive for a year here in the Commonwealth. I wonder, especially with your global focus, can you put it in context for us? How is it weird? Is it crazy? Or is it totally to be expected that a governor would have a state in a state of emergency for an entire year, given the scale of what's going on?
Politically, it's not actually that unusual. And I think Americans probably don't realize how many emergency executive orders are issued by presidents. I actually was hoping, you know, in the before times that the American, the Congress would undertake to limit that power and not, you know, again, unrelated to any partisan issue here, that I just think the presidency is too strong. So we have all kinds of executive orders that are based on emergency powers going back 20, 30, 40 years. So I don't think in a global context, it's that unusual, simply because during a crisis like a pandemic, I think the government is well within its scope to say, look, we need to do some things for the duration, you know, in World War II, you know, for the duration of 4 years to get through. And these are powers that we will give back, that we will, you know, not continually ask the public to observe, but that it is for the duration of the problem. So I don't think politically it's that unusual. What I am struck by is that people just sort of forgot about it. And I would keep reminding people who were complaining about this. And sometimes they were, you know, my friends or students or, you know, colleagues. And I would say, I'm sorry, but we are in a national emergency. This is not an inconvenience. This is not just a passing problem. This isn't, you know, like fixing hurricane damage. This is a national crisis of the kind we have not seen in decades. And I think it took it think it was just hard for people to internalize that.
Yeah.
No, I
so
think
Arlene,
I
you are.
Actually, I'm sorry.
Yep. I was going to you anyway.
our state legislature did rise to the occasion. I give them a lot of kudos for some of the legislation that they quickly passed on, you know, eviction moratoriums and foreclosure moratoriums and helping people with unemployment insurance if they were independent contractors in our ever-increasing gig economy. Or they just recently passed emergency pay or are working on emergency paid sick leave. So they could have done more, but they have done a lot that has helped millions of people get through the last 12 months.
I appreciate that. That was actually what I was going to ask you. Tom, go ahead. One more note, and then we'll go to some phones.
Sure. I was just going to kind of, you know, pile on there with Arlene's point to say, you know, for especially at the state and local level, if people are critical of the way a lot of this was handled, remember, there was no game plan for this. We, you know, this is a once in a hundred year thing. And I think, you know, everybody, I think most of the states, there are notable exceptions, but I think most state and local officials really did the best they could with something that, you know, until now, we, as I said earlier, you know, we thought only existed in science fiction movies. So, you know, that it's not a perfect response, but when you've never seen something like this and never had to deal with it, you know, that it becomes improvisation.
All right, let's go to the phones here before we take a break. 800-423-8255. We've got some callers who want to share stories of grace and people warming their hearts. Let's start with Catherine in Cambridge. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a teacher, and today was the one-year anniversary of my school going remote. We're now mostly in person, some hybrid, and I asked my students today what they would go back and tell themselves from a year ago, and it was unusually touching. They said things like, I would tell myself to stay safe and stay busy. I would tell myself, don't worry, remote schooling isn't as bad as you fear. I would tell myself this time next year you'll already have the vaccine. And one of them said, well, I don't remember talking to myself last year, so obviously I didn't.
Yeah. And how old are your students, Catherine, can I ask?
They are high school students with complex special needs.
Fantastic. Catherine, thanks for sharing that story. I want to grab a couple more. We've got Sharon on the line from Brookline. Sharon, go ahead.
Hi. I just remember the second week of the pandemic, shopping in Star Market, and I had gone in Star Market and I didn't have a mask because there were none to be found.
Right.
And I was with my 7-year-old daughter and she didn't have one. We just had scarves covering our mouth and nose. Sorry, I'm getting worked
okay,
up over
Sharon.
This again. And a store clerk ran up to us and he gave us masks so that we could protect ourselves. And it was just a very touching moment during a very scary time.
Thank you for sharing it with us, Sharon. We'll take one more here. Liz from North Andover. Liz, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, that's the last comment is kind of timely because I was one of the mask makers early on. And we, you know, I dusted off my sewing machine and we went on the hunt for elastic and fabric. And elastic was incredibly hard to come by. But, you know, we were putting the word out on Facebook and people were dropping things on my doorstep. And I was just churning out masks that I gave to friends that worked at nursing homes and neighbors. And people would just randomly contact me on Facebook and say, hey, do you have a couple? I need them for X, Y, and Z. And it just, you know, it felt like we were actually helping. And from that last caller, it sounds like it was indeed appreciated when somebody could get a mask for their face. So
Isn't that great?
That felt good.
And we're kind of expanding the week to the year as we are in the one-year anniversary of the state of emergency in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Still with us, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, Arlene Isaacson, and Tom Nichols, a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Before the break, we heard several of you call in with stories of kindness, acts of charity, acts of mutual aid. We're going to keep those coming. And listeners, we're going to start talking about vaccines again, too, which we always hear from lots of you. So call with those acts of kindness and call with your vaccination stories, your pre-registration stories now, 800-423-8255. And I'm going to start with one more call here, Dave in Norwood. Dave, go ahead.
I just wanted to report it. It hasn't been all bad for everyone. This has been one of the best years of my life. I got a new job last May. Prior to that, my college-age kids moved back in, and they were with me every day pretty much until September. My sixth grade daughter actually started, her math scores improved tremendously, primarily as a result of hybrid learning. The company that I work for was buying us lunch every day for a number of months, just and all the directors of the company were in the office every day just to promote the fact that it was a safe place to be, and it's one of the safest places I felt all year. So, yeah, it's not all bad news.
Good, Dave. I'm really glad to hear that. So, Tom Nichols, Arlene Isaacson, thanks for staying with us through the break there. We spent the first part of the show really looking back, and I want to take stock of where we are now. It feels kind of impossible to do that without talking about vaccines. And Tom has already mentioned that maybe one of the places we were at our best is that our medical community and our research community here helped fast track vaccines so that only a year into this pandemic, we've got shots in, what, over 750,000 two doses into arms in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Arlene, are you feeling like you can breathe again now? Are you feeling like it's been a year, but it's only going to be maybe a little bit longer?
Well, when I talk to my friends, there is some sense of that. I remember early on in the pandemic, walking around the streets of the city at dusk, and it was like the Twilight Zone, standing at the intersection of Arlington Street and Boylston, or near the Park Plaza, and places that are usually congested with traffic at 5 o'clock, and it was completely empty, no cars, no people, no nothing. And it was eerie. And now my friends and I have all discussed feeling a little bit more hopeful, seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, but I think there's some degree of hesitancy, a reluctance to fully believe until we get there, a fear, a what if. You know, it looks like things are getting better. It looks like we're going to be okay. It looks like we're going to make it through. It looks like we're around, almost about to turn the corner. But there's an awareness that things could go south, and that under it sort of clouds the joy.
So, Tom, there is that sense that everything kind of hangs in the balance. I'm nowhere near qualifying for a vaccine, but I did mostly to see what the user experience was going to be like. I went and did the new pre-registration this morning, which as earlier today, I read that at that point, 200,000 people in the Commonwealth today had done it. The system didn't crash. It was actually quite easy. I wonder if we had gotten some things like that right earlier, even if the vaccine scarcity, et cetera, had been the same, would we be feeling a little more like we were trusting we were on solid ground now? Did we pay a psychological price for some of the bumpiness of this vaccine rollout, despite the fact that we were able to get vaccines in arms fairly early into this pandemic from an historic standpoint?
Yeah, we did lose some of that, but unfortunately that's, you know, that shows how how much we've come to expect an incredibly high level of performance from our governing and technological elites. So I think, you know, part of the return to normal will be that we will, you know, sort of get past the fear that it could all collapse all over again. I'm 60. So, you know, we're just, the bar is just coming down. I'm sort of, you know, kind of feel like I'm peeking over the transom and saying, you know, can I come in now? But you know, I also and everyone else, we have to be realistic to say, for, you know, for the rest of my life, you know, sure, COVID could kill me. So could the flu. So could a lot of things. Now, you know, we're just trying to return all the risks of life to normal, within normal parameters, rather than, and I think we should get away from this expectation that, you know, in the before time, everything was perfectly safe. It wasn't. I mean, we were, you know, we were getting flu shots. I mean, I went for my checkup and my doctor kind of gave me the stink eye and said, you need a flu shot right now. You know, and that'll be, I hope the new normal will be, you know, are you 60, 65, get a flu shot, get a shingles vaccine, get a COVID shot. And just say, this is part of normal life. And I think we're going to get there. I think this is just the, you know, I think Arlene, I totally feel what Arlene's saying, because this is a normal part of not daring to hope just as things are, you know, getting better. But I think I think we are on that path, but it's going to rely on us to adjust our expectations back to where they were before the pandemic to say, you know, life is full of normal risks, and this will just be one more of them.
1-800-423-8282. Go ahead, Arlene.
I think the difference is that there were always fears and worries about, you know, you could be hit by a car, but we didn't usually worry about, oh God, if I get the flu, will I end up on a ventilator? And what would happen if I managed to survive the ventilator? How broken will my body be after that? Or for the long haulers, the people who have mild symptoms, but it seems to last for months and months and months. So the nature of the fears have changed quantitatively and qualitatively, but I think it will get better. And the balancing act we're all gonna have to do is how overenthusiastic anyone might feel at any time about the risks they can take going forward. And what are the risks going forward?
So listeners, I'm gonna sort of overstate this. 800-423-8255. Are you a little more team Arlene, still feeling a little worried, a little hesitant, a little more team Tom, feeling optimistic, you know, about where we're gonna go? Have you done the pre-registration for a vaccine? Have you gotten your shot? How does that feel? 800-423-8255. I'm going to take a bunch of calls here because we've also still got people calling with those wonderful stories of being good, doing good, and experiencing good during this pandemic. Rob's on the line from Watertown. Rob, go ahead.
Good afternoon. So
hi,
when
Rob.
This all started, I live on the street that the Marathon bomber was caught on 7 years ago. And the words came to mind for all of us to shelter in place.
Mm.
Did that, and I'm 67, and 5 or 6 years ago, I learned how to sew. In my anxiousness, I started sewing masks, and I would stick them in plastic sandwich bags and hang them on hooks from an apple tree in my front yard. People in town would come by and collect them, thank me for it. And that alleviated my anxiety a little bit.
And it's Rob, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Go ahead. It's just been what, Rob? Go ahead.
It's just been a nice way for me to alleviate my anxiety through all this. And
yeah, and that's what I wanted to.
Second.
You got your second shot. Fantastic, Rob. I'm sorry to let you go. I mean, we mean no disrespect by that. I want to pick up on that thread, which is that being of service sometimes is what takes us out of our fear, right? Takes us out of our anxiety. I do want to go to a couple more calls, but Arlene, is there a model there for us of service to others that actually could be part of the healing process of dealing with trauma?
Oh, absolutely. It is a huge relief and something that in times that are bad or times that are good, we all want to do more of. There's also the small ways that weren't necessarily ways of good, but just ways of being respectful. I have two daughters who I was very pleased were pretty COVID careful, and they faced the challenge of being with friends, some of whom were not so. And we've all had to learn how to socialize in that new, brave new world. You know, how do you say to someone, you're standing a little too close, gee, would you put a mask on? It's hard for full grown adults to do it. And I think it's especially hard for young adults to handle that social quandary. And at one point, I know one of my daughters would meet her friends and they'd sit in the trunk of their cars in a circle so that they could visit with each other in a parking lot. You know, some randomly chosen parking lot. So people were using creative ways of interacting and trying to normalize the weird world we've been in.
I want to go back to the phones here and grab Aubrey in Somerville. Aubrey, go ahead.
Hi, how's it going? So I wanted to tell kind of a nice story. I was in grad school in Florida when the pandemic hit, and I didn't have anywhere to go. School ended early, and my sister in Somerville actually took me in for free, has let me stay with her the entire last year. which has been amazing because my unemployment never went through. And I'm high, that's another story. I'm high risk because of asthma, and whenever I get a cold, it turns into pneumonia or bronchitis. And so initially I wasn't even, I didn't qualify for any of the phases, even as of yesterday morning. And then my boyfriend, who's in New York, texted me and was like, have you seen this? I think you might actually qualify. And I was like, no, I don't. You know, I'm not, they're not coming to me yet. And he was like, no, 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 look. And it turns out that because I'm a tutor and I tutor a couple of my students
there you go.
In person, that I was able to just sign up and I'm going right now to get my first vaccine.
Oh, that's fantastic, just- Aubrey. Congratulations. Aubrey is on her way in the car right now. And you hear that voice, Tom Nichols. There's a, that is a voice of hope, right? That is a voice that's seeing around the corner. You know, we've had so many equity issues with vaccines. Aubrey now qualifies, and clearly somebody who felt her health was at risk because of the steps the state has taken around teachers. And that is, we will have to go to a break soon, but it is something I want to touch on before then. Remarkable day yesterday with a battle between the Massachusetts teachers unions and Governor Baker over the process for vaccination. The governor getting very angry with the teachers associations for wanting to sort of streamline straight to them through their own process. And the governor saying, I'm not going to do that. And then the teachers union saying that is a mischaracterization. I want to give you both pieces of sound. So for in the studio, I'd like to go with Week in Review 7. This is Governor Baker's office putting out a strongly worded statement. And then the governor saying this.
I am not going to be in a position where I take vaccine away from people who are extremely vulnerable, who have multiple medical conditions and are over the age of 65, to give it to a targeted population. We're just not going to play that game.
Ironically, just after he had made that statement, we actually had already booked on our show American Federation of Teachers Massachusetts President Beth Kontos. So she responded pretty much real time to that rejection by Baker.
That was an extreme reaction, and I, at no time are we talking about taking vaccines away from the elderly or hard-hit populations. Quite frankly, it's untrue and defamatory.
So very strong words on both sides. We've talked a lot about the ways we've been good to each other, but in this time of vaccine scarcity, people are also pitted against each other, and you can hear it there. What do you make of the situation between the Commonwealth and teachers?
Well, as a teacher myself, but at the obviously at the college level, there's plenty of blame to go around. I think that I had the same anxiety about going to the classroom. I thought that, you know, the institutions I work for, and by the way, I don't represent the War College or Harvard Extension, you know, they took different paths to it, but they were both highly cautious. I would love to get back in the classroom. But I also understand the anxiety of walking into a room with a group of people who are unvaccinated and may not be practicing, you know, good COVID best practices. On the other hand, I think, you know, the teachers' unions around the country have been pretty obstinate about this. And, you know, there's almost, it's difficult to choose a side here because I understand the parents. I have a high school, my daughter's a high school senior who has lost her senior year. And I grieve for that. But I, you know, like other teachers, I didn't want to walk in and, you know, die just to teach a class. But there has to be some kind of compromise here. You know, we have to get out of this trench warfare. And I think, you know, the vaccine is going to be the way out of this. And we're just going to have to, you know, again, shoulder a certain amount of risk and understand that life is risk, that's just something we're going to have to deal with.
And you know, listeners, if you have, and Arlene, give me just a second here. Listeners, if you have reactions to the back and forth between the teachers unions and the governor yesterday as that news unfolded, we welcome those reactions too at 800-423-8255. Arlene, go ahead.
I think it was very unfair. That was of the governor to mischaracterize the teacher's position in that way, because no, they are certainly not saying take from everybody else to give to us. What they are saying is that they want to get back into the classroom because they love their kids. and they want to be there, and they know it would be helpful to have kids to be teaching face to face. But what's the risk? I mean, it's one thing to teach a high school student, but when you're dealing with little kids, the ones who are going back first are dealing with little kids or special needs kids, dozens of them, sometimes hundreds, depending on the grade level, in schools, many of which are poorly ventilated, don't have windows that don't open. And if they do open, and if it's 30 degrees outside, what the hell do you do? Or you're dealing with the kids who are, you know, they have attention deficits where they have trouble sitting still. What do you do with those kids? You want to take care of them, but if you can't get close to them, that's a real problem and it's a real challenge. I mean, remember, teachers have had to advocate for air filters in their rooms. They've had to advocate for windows to be open. They've had to advocate for soap in the school for students. Think about that. They had to advocate for soap. So to just say to someone, oh, go into that environment anyway and do risk your life, even though we haven't adequately provided appropriate circumstances for you, I think is unfair.
All right. So far this hour, we've talked about yesterday and today on this 1 year anniversary. We're going to go to a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about tomorrow and we're going to continue to take listener calls, especially in reaction to where we are with teachers. Before that break, I'm just going to grab one more of the happy stories or the kindness stories. We've got Jean and Acton. Jean, go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Actually, to the point of teachers, I just wanted to add to my story that our daughter, who I'm going to talk about, is actually a high school student who has special needs, and her special needs school has been virtual, her private school, the whole year. So that's been an interesting experience for all of us. But the three of us in my family got COVID in late March, just about a year ago, so coming on the one-year anniversary. And it was very frightening because so little was known. But I wanted to say how wonderful everybody in our community was. Our Unitarian Church, our neighbors, my family, and our actual medical offices made us feel supported. When you started off asking about what do you remember vividly, for 2 weeks I sat there and watched my husband, who was the sickest, and wondered when and if I had to take him to the hospital, and thinking that then he would be ending up on a ventilator. So for 2 full weeks I watched him. And nobody could tell me very much except, you know, look for these symptoms. And he didn't. And he's just getting over his long hauler syndrome. So I will never forget the warmth and the love that was shown to us how cool it was that we depend on each other so very much.
Let us take it back from you there, Jean. Thank you for sharing that story. And more to the point, I'm delighted that you're well. We've been doing a bit of a year in review in this full 12 months now of the pandemic on the anniversary of the state's state of emergency. These last few minutes of Week in Review, we're going to look forward. And so if any of you want to call in and just tell us what you're hopeful for, what you're looking forward to on the other side, 800-423-8255. Still with us, Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic, and Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks for staying with us. I do want to grab just a couple of minutes on the COVID-19 American Rescue Plan. And right out of the gate, I'm going to play some sound for you. We spoke with Congresswomen Catherine Clark and Lori Trahan earlier this week on the day it was passed. Lori Trahan touched on the bipartisan support the bill had outside of Washington. Here she is.
It's not a coincidence that economists, public health experts, Democratic, Republican, and independent state and local officials have come out in support of the American Rescue Plan. It's going to shave an entire year off our projected return to full employment and mitigate millions of job loss this year alone.
So, Arlene, here in the Commonwealth, I think we'd all love to have an entire year shaved off of return to full employment. Do you believe that'll happen for us here in New England?
Well, I think the benefit of the American Rescue Plan that just passed in D.C. is going to be enormous, to the extent that it'll do things like cut child poverty in half, which is an unbelievable goal that they'll be achieving. And I think, you know, to link something you were talking about earlier about the good that people are doing and how it might bleed into this last phase would be one of my daughters is involved in an organization called FarmLink, where they connect farms that have excess produce because all the restaurants were closed and didn't buy their produce to food banks around the country. And so the question is, will that continue on? And based on what she's shown me and told me, it will. And it will not, perhaps the need will be slightly diminished once people are back to work and can afford their own food. But what a wonderful thing that it will continue on. not just in Massachusetts, but across the country.
That is encouraging. Tom, I'm going to bring you the voice of another one of our members of the congressional delegation, Richard Neal, speaking in the House this week about what he thinks the stimulus is going to do for Americans. And I want you to zero in on how he describes the legislation. Here he is.
Sadly, we cannot take away the pain and the suffering of our friends, neighbors, and loved ones. But with this seismic legislation, we are delivering much-needed help and relief to millions of our fellow Americans.
He says seismic legislation, Tom. At the end of the day, that's my question for you. Is this sort of immediate and proportionate response to an economic crisis, or is it more of a progressive reshaping of our American economy and government, a la Great Society and the Great Depression? What's your reaction there?
I think it's bigger than an immediate relief plan and smaller than the Great Society. And I think, you know, those conservatives who are concerned about the size of this package, and I'm not sure that one, I worked in Congress, you know, for folks that haven't heard me here before, I worked both on Beacon Hill in the House, and I worked in the Senate in Washington. And I think like all these kinds of legislation, they always get larded up with a whole bunch of things that are in addition to the thing you need to do. But for those conservatives out there that are concerned about that, if the Republicans had actually wanted to engage in good faith rather than simply saying, you know, we're going to kill whatever the Biden administration does, it might have been a different bill. So I think it's probably it certainly does what it needs to do. I think it's probably bigger than it needed to be, but that's because elections have consequences. And when you don't cooperate with the other guys about making a bill into a better bill, you get what you get. So I don't have any real heartburn about the relief bill. And I think the Biden administration is, here's another kind of positive thing for the future. I really enjoy how much we don't have to think every day about what the Biden administration's doing. And we have plenty of evidence that they're just sort of going to work and doing what they need to do, which is kind of a nice change. By and large, it's a good record.
Yeah, it's great to have a wide range of things to talk about that don't all kind of originate out of the White House. I have noticed that actually over the last few weeks. Arlene, we're talking about a huge measure there. In a minute, I'll go to a couple more calls for us. But before then, what other measures, what other steps do we need to take, whether that's at the federal level or here in the Commonwealth, to really stabilize the ground, the economic ground, the social ground, under our citizens here in the Commonwealth to be able to move forward when we reach the point where things are able to start to turn back to normal?
Well, the federal package will make an enormous difference, and it should enable our state to invest more in education and help those who are going to be facing moratoriums and facing evictions or foreclosures. And figuring out ways to help those folks as well going down the pike. And we now have a greater insight into the devastating consequences of systemic racism on our healthcare system and our education system, but especially how people are treated and can access food and healthcare. And we're going to have to be working on that continually.
I'm going to go back to the phones here and grab a couple of calls. 800. Well, I won't put the number out because honestly, we won't get to more calls after this. So I'll just go to Lisa in Westford. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. I teach middle school earth science, and I have a shout out to my colleague who got me a vaccination appointment, and I'm so very happy about that. I almost cried. I've been very disillusioned with Governor Baker and Jeffrey Riley. It hurts. And I think part of the reason why it hurts so much is that we've already always been embattled. Most people are awesome. Parents are awesome to us. But a lot of people out there in the world say all kinds of things about teachers and teaching. I mean, anything from the little, like, you don't work in the summer, to the other burdens we have of, like, students' mental health. And then that's the background to all this, so that now when this pandemic happens, I think a lot of us were already not doing so great morale-wise. And then this happens, and the governor makes you feel like you're robbing little elderly ladies of their shots. And it's not that. It's just we spend an hour with four different groups of students. I'll have about 100 students. My own son now has to go full time and at a shorter distance, and I wasn't really mentally prepared for that either. For 6 weeks of change of school.
Yes. Yeah.
In my school,
Lisa,
all the furniture is in
the gym. I'm
going
to take it back. Lisa, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I don't mean to, but I'm going to take it back from you there because we're a little short on time, and I don't want to lose the first part of what you had to say, this moment where you almost cried, but also dismayed about the fight you had to be in to get there. And I think that's kind of capturing the moment that we're in. Lisa, thank you for giving us a way to wrap up the review of this week. So Tom and Arlene, I'm going to turn back to you. I want to leave room for our hubbubs, which are those local stories that caught our attention this week. Tom, do you have a brief hubbub for us?
Well, as always, my hubbub, because I am a son of the Commonwealth, but I live in Rhode Island. My hubbub is a Rhode Island regional one. And I just love the fact that although we all mourned the passing of Benny's, the great hardware store, our local vaccination center here where I live is the old Benny's. And of course, Rhode Islanders always navigate by where things used to be. So it's been wonderful here on the island to hear people saying, hey, we're going to the Benny's again in this very excited, positive way. You know, it's almost like the state knew that putting it in this beloved location would be a good public relations move, because that's down here when people say they're going to Benny's now, they mean they're getting a vaccination.
It's like putting it in a Dunkin' Donuts. Absolutely, Tom. Arlene, what do you have for us for a hubbub this week?
Well, because I take so much solace in finding humor, lightheartedness in certain topics, things like Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. I came upon a posting recently by a gay actor named Leslie Jordan. You may not recognize his name, but you doubtless would his voice and face if you heard it. He apparently put together on Instagram a short video in which he first commended Meghan Markle for speaking her truth this past week. And then in his cute little Southern accent, he talked about the fact that, "I hope those kids know what they're getting into, because I'm just afraid that the royals are going to try and smoke her." And at the end, I particularly enjoyed the fact that he said the gays, and I think he's referring to himself and the rest of us. He said, "The gays are going to have Meghan Markle's back." And I laughed when I heard that and realized he's right, because that's just what happened with Harry's mother, Diana. The gays definitely had Diana's back. And I'm sure we're going to do it with Meghan, so stay tuned, y'all.
Well, there you go. And that's awesome, both of you. I'll just give you guys a fast one. Spring forward on Sunday, and momentum is building to never fall back again, and I am all for it. All right, Arlene Isaacson, Tom Nichols, thanks for joining us on Friday's Radio Boston Week in Review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, have a great weekend, everybody. We'll hear you and talk to you again on Monday.